Chapter 35, In the Belly of the Beast. As the summer of 1972 progressed, the National Party grew to hundreds of members, including at least 100 active high school and college students in the New Orleans area. We held parades, public meetings, and literature distributions. Our office on Domain Street became the makeshift headquarters for the New Orleans George Wallace campaign, recruiting young people, raising funds, and distributing Wallace literature and paraphernalia. One afternoon in late June, police besieged our office. My girlfriend, Chloe Harden, co-workers Hamilton Barrett and Lewis Darn, and I were arrested under the charge of theft for supposedly misrepresenting ourselves as Wallace campaigners. Handcuffed, the four of us watched as our files and personal possessions were rifled and trashed. Our membership records were seized, and our checkbook and much of our literature were boxed, sealed up, and carted away. Even my private personal correspondence with Chloe and with my parents was taken. As I watched the agents tear apart my office, mouthing obscenities against me and my friends, I felt as though I'd entered a Franz Kafka tale, or perhaps an historical account of a communist KGB agent's sacking of an office of newspapers or dissidents in Eastern Europe. We were opposed to drugs. We didn't cheat in college. We didn't even litter. But suddenly, our freedom was being taken away, our personal possessions confiscated, and our political organization smashed, all because we challenged the status quo. Exhausted, demoralized, and scared, I was fingerprinted, photographed, front and side, and then locked in a small holding room, perhaps 7 feet by 9. A passed-out drunk and I were alone with a prisoner who loomed like a frightful, dark apparition. "Give me your money," the figure growled as soon as I was left alone with him. "Hand it over now." His bloodshot eyes resembled hot coals, and he stared at me with an intense focus that I pretended to ignore. It was not bravery that made me refuse to hand over my last bits of change to the 250-pound, cornrow-haired black who threatened me. I was just taking the course I felt that I must to survive. I desperately needed my change to use the payphone to reach people who might be able to get my comrades and me out of jail. The New Orleans Police Intelligence Division had been running a campaign of nonstop harassment against my fellow activists and me. Freddie O'Sullivan ran it, a former Vice Squad cop who, despite his seemingly Irish name, proved to be a member of Turo Synagogue. A huge picture of communist revolutionary Leon Trotsky adorned a wall of his police office headquarters. Whatever his attachments to the persona of Trotsky, he later turned out to be such a committed Zionist that he immigrated to Israel a few years later. O'Sullivan and his cohorts repeatedly showed up at our meetings, often sticking cameras in visitors' faces and obnoxiously using the flash. The agents would obtrusively take photos and make it clear that all visitors of our public meetings were under intense surveillance by police. These were clear violations of our civil rights, but even more damaging was their intimidation of our members at their workplace or school. Some lost their jobs. Many more lost heart. Many local police departments had their own brand of dirty tricks, their own miniature versions of COINTELPRO, to use on political troublemakers like us. We have been fully authorized as Wallace campaign headquarters by his national office in Montgomery, Alabama. We had sent in the national office money, ordered extensive campaign supplies, and they had addressed... We had been fully authorized as Wallace campaign headquarters by his national office in Montgomery, Alabama. We had sent the national office money and ordered extensive campaign supplies, and they had addressed all the packages and correspondence to us as the, quote, New Orleans Wallace Campaign Headquarters, unquote. acknowledging us as the proper local representatives of the campaign. O'Sullivan, however, had cleverly telephoned the Montgomery headquarters and asked the staff if David Duke, a Ku Klux Klan leader, was connected to the George Wallace campaign for president. Fearing a scandal, the Wallace worker on the phone defensively said that Wallace had no connection to any Klansmen, no connection to me. On that pretext, O'Sullivan triumphantly dispatched a caravan of squad cars to arrest us for theft. Also, because we had many young people working in the campaign, they added the specious charge of, quote, contributing to delinquency of minors, because minors were involved with us volunteering in the streets for George Wallace, an offense that would appear to most law-abiding people as some sort of sex abuse charge. My three comrades and I were idealistic and naive, easy prey for the corrupt and dirty world of the New Orleans ex-vice squad agents. We found ourselves in a 95% black jail. I only had $100 in the bank and no attorney. But my most immediate problem was this huge creature demanding the few nickels I had in my pocket. I did not know it at that moment, but I later found out that the brute was a convicted murderer who had just been recaptured after an escape. Unfortunately, I was then under the delusion that one should always stand up to a bully. For most of my life, that principle had worked quite well, for even if I lost a fight, I was less likely to be picked on again. A code that had practicality in the schoolyard, however, was unrealistic in a contemporary American jail. Later I learned from more experienced white prisoners that sometimes one had to submit to a degree of petty theft, humiliation, and intimidation to survive, but that one still had to have, of course, a clear line of how far to go in accommodating the powers around you. Most whites drew that line at the sexual advances of the black prisoners. There are at least 500,000 homosexual rapes in American jails each year. Black perpetrators commit a vast majority of them against white victims. It is a subject that's often joked about in the media, but the high frequency of this bestial practice is certainly one of the most terrible symptoms of the barbarism to which our society has sunk. Obviously, severe punishment, including a much wider use of the death penalty, is appropriate for violent criminals. But there can be no clearer example of constitutionally prohibited, cruel, and unusual punishment than the widespread homosexual rape plaguing our prisons. Its ubiquity is one more proof that the U.S. Constitution means little today to our rulers. Rather than upset politically correct notions of racial equality, young white men are forced to suffer the ultimate in personal torture and indignity. The media ignore this travesty, or, again, make humor about it, and I, like most, had not thought much about the subject until my incarceration made me fear its ugly threat. My resolve was simply to fight to the death, if need be, to prevent such an act. If I were to be raped, I decided that my assailants would defile only my dead body. The only other prisoner besides my tormentor in that tiny holding cell was white, but he was passed out, drooling on the wooden bench that lined one of the walls. The menacing Negro was unlike any of the friendlier black souls I had known when, as a young man, I had worked at Gary's Garage. As the murderer approached me, I fully realized his immense size. He looked like a heavyweight boxer, tall and stocky, with a bull neck mounted on wide and powerful shoulders. He viewed my 6'2", thin, 175-pound, white-skinned frame with contempt. He took a boxer's stance and feigned a punch, to which I raised my fists. He began to taunt me. "Yeah, you a prize fighter, huh? You a prize fighter." Muttering incoherent strings of unintelligible words, spiced with obscenities, he worked himself into a frenzy. balling up his fists and contorting his face until it looked as though the veins in his neck would explode. I picked up my hands and put them in front of my chin, tightly closed my fists, and braced for the onslaught. Suddenly, the jangling sound of keys broke the silence. A guard appeared, carrying a 6-inch brass ring of keys. He opened the door and pushed 5 more prisoners into the crowded cell. 4 of them happened to be white, unusually. I felt like a prisoner on death row getting a last-second reprieve from the governor. The murderer just recoiled against the wall and stared silently at me. Finally, he spoke again. "I'll see you again, and you find out how it works in here. You see me again." An hour later, they moved me into the drunk tank. The cell was a 15-foot square, terrazzo floored room with no benches or chairs. Its only adornment, a urinal on a red brick wall. It was blazing hot, late June, but this cell was air-conditioned, and I felt freezing cold in my short-sleeved, thin cotton dress shirt. Vomit dripped off the edge of the urinal, and the stench was sickening. But I was so emotionally exhausted that nothing could keep me from stretching out, shivering, on the dirty stone floor. I laid my head on my forearm and quickly passed into a dream state, only to awake intermittently from my shivers and the commotion as prisoners were brought in and out. A guard's thick hands shook me awake about 6 a.m. Soon I was reunited with my 2 friends, Hamilton and Lewis. We were transferred to 2 dirty 2-man cells in the central lockup. Lewis in one cell, Hamilton and I in the other. Each cell had a rusty upper and lower bunk with no mattress, and each was stifling hot in the steam bath humidity of New Orleans. Because they had booked us so late, we could not be arraigned before a judge until the following morning. Given a chance to use the telephone down the hall, I called Jim Lindsay to arrange for a lawyer and was soon locked back with Hamilton in the closet-sized cell. We made up revolutionary songs, told jokes, and made imaginary revolutionary speeches through the bars. Then we both became silent, imagining ourselves being framed, convicted, and sentenced to years in prison. I also thought about Chloe. I hated to picture her in this filthy and brutal place. I recalled cool spring nights when I lay next to her in the soft, moist grass around the lake at LSU. In that time and place, love was pure, and it seemed that if our dreams were passionate enough, they might just come true. In Sir Walter Scott's classics, I thought, right always triumphed in the end. I had not anticipated then that standing up for the things I believed in could harm the most sincere and beautiful person I knew, the person I cared about most in the world. Night fell, but the heat lingered, and we soaked in our own hot sweat. After swapping small talk of our fears and our faith, Hamilton and I found sleep on the rust-coated bunks. But not for long. I awoke from a heavy sleep with a sensation of something stinging my face. I sat up, realizing in horror that it was a roach. I had felt the prickly sensation of this 3 or 4-inch-long creature biting at my flesh. In the dim light, we could make out a half-dozen more of these prehistoric monsters, scrambling along the crevices in the wall or scuttling across the floor outside the bars. We could hear them as we tried to return to sleep, sounding more like buzzing machines than living things as they took flight. It was as if they were waiting for us to close our eyes before they began their air attack, pouncing on our bunks and us. When we could, we struck at the roaches with our shoes. Hamilton and I cynically tried to make a game of it, keeping count of the feral creatures we had killed. I knew that Chloe hated roaches even more than I did, and I worried about what she must be facing in the women's section. I prayed that she was better off than we were. By morning, we were exhausted. We reeked of sweat. Our clothes were crisscrossed with streaks of brown powder and spotted with tiny rust flakes. It was in this condition that we were sent to our arraignment. Arraignment was to be held in the Orleans Parish Courthouse, two blocks away. The courthouse was connected to the infamous Orleans Parish Prison, a place where the news reports frequently reported inspections that uncovered drugs and weapons. It also had more than a modest share of assaults, murders, and suicides. Handcuffed to a dozen other prisoners, Hamilton, Lewis, and I snaked through the hallways, down the stairs, into and out of a van, and up a staircase to an adjoining holding cell just outside the courtroom. My two comrades were with me in a cell holding perhaps 25 inmates, of whom perhaps 9 or 10 were white. In the cell directly across from us were about 30 blacks. Their cell had a large black panther crudely sketched in charcoal on the wall, the capital letters BPP underneath. They had also crudely scrawled several misspelled black power slogans on the gray painted brick. Open toilets, slopped with human waste, adorned both cells. Women waiting for arraignment were held in the cell diagonal to ours. I caught sight of my beloved Chloe. She tried to put on a brave smile. My eyes began to glaze over, but I bit my lip and told myself that I had to be strong for her and for my younger friends. The blacks in the crowded cell directly across from mine caught sight of Chloe in the woman's cell. Her beauty had persevered through a difficult night, and she looked as though a ray of light illuminated her in comparison to the dark, rough-hewn criminal elements surrounding her. The blacks began to taunt her, calling out and mocking the crude acts that they wanted to do to her. It pains me just to remember the vicious, pornographic, sadistic things they told Chloe. Here was an American girl who came from a loving Christian home who now faced unspeakable filth, humiliation, and terror simply for defending the beautiful heritage of our people and country, and for daring to love and believe in me. Like we three men, Chloe tried to be strong. I got the impression that she was trying to be strong for me. She knew it made me suffer, knowing that I was powerless to rescue her. As the obscene trash talk mounted, I could see tears glistening in her eyes and her lips beginning to quiver as she turned her face down into her hands. Jealous of all the attention given to Chloe, the black woman in her cell also turned on her with verbal abuse as she retreated to the back of the cell and sobbed. Hatred in me against the animals that would treat a woman so cruelly. Ridding the earth of the filthy scum in that cell would have been a highly moral act. No doubt my opponents will interpret these words as proof of my depravity. So be it. But I would hold that it is a depraved society that allows the highest and most beautiful creations of God to be defiled by such vile creatures. I know that sustained hatred destroys the hater as much as the hated, and that the greatest works and treasures of man are truly built in the service of love and creation, not hatred and bitterness. Yet when we lose the capacity to hate evil or those who inflict it on the innocent, we have lost a tool necessary for survival. At that point, we would become the perfect slaves, bereft of emotion, ready to endure any indignity, any wrong, and any tyranny as long as the name of love is invoked. When the passion comes back to the hearts of our people, only then shall we triumph. We were finally called into court. I informed the judge that all of us had clean records and pointed out to him that many of the violent criminals who preceded us were given release on their own recognizance. The prosecution argued that we were such political radicals that the bond should be kept high. Our political incorrectness kept our bond higher than we could pay. As the guards led us to the lower floors of Parrish Prison, Hamilton turned to me and said sarcastically, "I'm so thankful that I live in America where you can't be imprisoned for your political beliefs." Once again, we were chained to other prisoners in the box and marched out of the courtroom to face new perils. Chloe's eyes followed me all the way out of the courtroom, but in my own trepidation, I could not decide whether her look was one of pain or of disappointment in my failure to secure our freedom. Hamilton, Lewis, and I talked with a number of prisoners, and we knew that the worst was coming. Central Lockup, our previous jail, was luxurious compared to the bowels of Parrish Prison. I kept my ears open and frequently asked questions of the prisoners who knew what was ahead so that I could find out how to better protect myself and my friends. Guards first herded us into a room where they checked our valuables and money. Heeding the warnings of experienced prisoners, I checked every dollar I had, saving only a few nickels for the telephone. Most people entering jail for the first time think they should keep some money for personal needs like cigarettes, toiletries, and snacks. Not so in Parrish Prison. Most control over prisoners was by other prisoners called trustees. After formal check-in, we soon entered the large room, open room, in the basement of Parrish Prison. Hamilton and Lewis were relieved of whatever money they had kept with them. In fact, the black trustees took Hamilton's wallet in addition to the cash in it. There was no possibility of resisting their demands because the basement area, called A1 Receiving, housed about 60 criminal blacks and only 7 or 8 whites, and they were mostly winos and bums picked up for vagrancy and other petty offenses. In such a place, the black-skinned man is king. Anybody who resisted Negro rule was likely to be beaten to a pulp, raped, or possibly killed. No one dared report acts of violence or larceny for fear of being labeled a snitch and suffering the ultimate punishment for the worst offense in the prisoner's moral code. Before my time in jail, I had wondered how there could be so much drug use in prison considering its high cost. I learned firsthand that the drug dealers and users conduct regular shakedowns of other prisoners. There is so much cash in jail, in fact, that even a few guards are induced to sell drugs to prisoners inside the jail system, as on the outside, there is a vested economic interest in maintaining the status quo. My introduction to the main prison reminded me of the Hollywood version of Nazi concentration camps. After surrendering all of our clothes and valuables, showering, and being sprayed with insecticide to prevent diseases spread by fleas and lice, we changed into our jailhouse dungarees and walked into the main area of the large cell block around 11 a.m. The A1 holding area consisted of a large room divided by a corridor of iron bars. What I saw there was a nightmarish scene. Unfortunately, it wasn't a nightmare a man could wake up to. It was real. I have never seen a movie portraying scenes as repulsive as what my friends and I saw in the Orleans Parish prison. There was a seatless open toilet on a platform in the middle of one end of the larger room. It overflowed with human waste and vomit. Urine collected around the area like rain in street gutters after a thunderstorm. The stench permeated the entire cell block. It was extremely hot, And in New Orleans, hot means much more than just high temperature. It was so oppressively humid that sometimes you had to force yourself to breathe. There just wasn't enough oxygen in the air. Everyone not sitting directly in front of the large belt-driven fan at one end of the room was drenched in sweat. In addition to the oppressive odors of human excrement and the worst body odors imaginable, there was also an odor in the air that at first I couldn't identify, and then I realized what it was. The musky scent of semen. The blacks and whites segregated themselves. The one small group of whites sat together in a section of rusty benches and tables that reminded me of wagons circled against the Indians on the American frontier. The ebony prisoners were loud and boisterous, often argumentative, and the room echoed with alternating shouts of anger and raucous laughter. The white minority was quiet and sullen, its conversation low-key and usually between two or three prisoners at a time. Whites avoided making eye contact with the black prisoners, and when black trustees ordered some of the white prisoners to mop the floors or dispose of some trash, there was only quiet resignation as they did what they were told. One prisoner among us had a glazed look in his eyes and sat motionless and mute. I discovered to my horror that the man had been raped a few days before. When he stood up, I noticed bloodstains on the seat of his trousers. I asked one of the prisoners about it, and he said this was a common result of prison rapes. He then told me of a brutal practice sometimes used in prison rape. Attackers will use a razor blade to split the sphincter muscle to mechanically facilitate homosexual rape. The inmate told us of this practice as casually as if he had been talking about the weather. I could not help but look at the victim in a mixture of macabre fascination and pity. He seemed to sense my gaze, and when he turned his eyes to mine, it was as if I looked into the portals of hell. They were eyes without any glint of life and hope, eyes staring out from a dead shell. Seeing such barbarism in that forlorn place struck me in the pit of my stomach, and for a while I wondered if I would retch and add to the stench of the place. My friend Lewis was only 19, and he looked even younger, a handsome, young, freckle-faced lad who looked more like 16 than his real age. He had traveled to New Orleans from New York to work with me in the National Party. As soon as he had walked into the cell, the black inmates made fun of this slight, innocent-looking, red-haired kid. Immediately they began to taunt him with sexual propositions and innuendo. The black ringleader was named Derek. He was of medium height and fairly muscular build, but the source of his domination came not from his physical stature, but from his swift talk and intimidating swagger. Approaching us, he looked Lewis over from head to toe. He smiled and said, "You be my bitch tonight, Cherry Top." Immediately, the other blacks chimed in as well, calling him offensive names and spelling out in disgusting detail their sordid plans for him. Lewis just ignored them, but our apprehension mounted when whites told us how the place got even worse once night fell. We saw a couple of blacks across the room surreptitiously fondling what looked to be like a dagger or ice pick. On inquiry, our fellow prisoners told us that there were literally hundreds of knives and other weapons in the jail. It seems almost comical now to recount it, but in dead earnest, we tried to sharpen our plastic toothbrush handles under the tabletop. We hoped that they could be our defensive weapons in case of attack. It was still only midday, after a lunch of some Spam-type substance on mustard-smeared hard rolls that seemed more like paper than bread, a white teenager was added to our cell. His name was Tommy Brown, and he had long, straight, blonde hair that fell almost to his waist. He was a muscular, working kid with tattoos and a thick, brown leather wristband. I thought about how the Norse berserkers of the Middle Ages might have resembled him. Tommy had been arrested after his friend, who was driving, failed to obey a stop sign. As the officers wrote the driver a ticket, they noticed some tablets on the floor of the back seat. Although the driver insisted that they were his nephew's sweet tarts, sugar candy, as the test, by the way, later confirmed, Tommy and his friend were arrested on suspicion of drugs. Upon seeing Tommy and his long blonde tresses, Derek and his cohorts went wild. "They done locked a white woman with us in here. You going to be my honey tonight. We going to grab you by the hair and make you suck. I'll bend over you and have your white ass." Those were some of the remarks. Tommy ignored them. Derek asked in a falsetto voice what his name was.
"I'm Derek. Who are you?"
Returning the question with a piercing stare from his cold blue eyes, Tommy responded with a powerful defiance. "My name is my own business." Derek shot him a finger and began cursing him. Red with anger, Tommy put up his fists. The two men began to circle one another, and the trustees moved quickly to herd the rest of us into an adjacent cell. Evidently, they were going to allow the fight between Tommy and Derek. They were separating the others, we thought, to prevent a race riot. As all the whites, including me, were herded into another cell, I realized too late, far too late, that there were still 10 or 12 blacks left in the cell with Tommy. My heart sank, and my hands gripped the bars, shaking in anger as I saw a dozen blacks around Tommy. In a matter of seconds, they waded into him like a whirring machine, kicking, punching, tearing, and jabbing. Two of the assailants began cracking him over the head and hands with thick, heavy mop handles. Tommy could only try to cover his head and eyes as he slumped into a corner. The whole attack took only about 30 seconds. Then the cell doors were opened again, and we were allowed back into the main room. I rushed over to Tommy. He had a broken thumb and a concussion. His nose was bleeding. Dark blood trickled down from his left temple. As I helped him from the floor, Derek began to threaten me. But I ignored him and guided Tommy over to the sink to clean his wounds. I felt guilty for stupidly leaving him alone with those animals, but I was surely not going to let any of them stop me from helping him. After a few minutes, Tommy's hand, head, and eye were terribly swollen, and I was able to convince a trustee to take him to get first aid. Apparently, the black's bloodlust was satisfied for the moment, but Hamilton, Lewis, and I knew that our turn was coming. We had friends on the outside working to help find an honest judge who would sign a recognizance bond. If we could just somehow survive the coming night, we thought we might be released the next day. Hamilton suggested that in the movies, prisoners would sometimes deliberately strike guards so they could be put into the hole, meaning isolation or solitary. That idea became untenable when we discovered that the hole in this prison was a tiny cell inhabited by three or four of the worst blacks in the jail. Soon we overheard Derek and the other blacks arguing among themselves over which one would get the first chance to sodomize Lewis. Then we heard angry shouts from a group of blacks who had been listening to the radio while playing cards in a corner of the room. WYLD, the black music station, had announced that David Duke and three other white supremacists connected to the KKK had been arrested in New Orleans. Even the dumbest of the black inmates instantly understood who my friends and I were. For a moment, the whole cell block seemed to fall silent. At first, it seemed my media reputation intimidated them. The Klan had a reputation, although undeserved, like that of the Mafia. Some of the black inmates obviously thought that if they did anything to harm me, a godfather type of character, they might soon end up with their feet in cement at the bottom of the Mississippi. Eventually, though, emboldened by each other's comments, their group hatred and anger overcame their individual fears. Whispers and furtive looks became evil stares and a hissing anger that boiled over into indecipherable gibberish and threats of torture and death toward the three of us. "Wait till tonight," was their refrain. By a fortunate circumstance, once a week, Orleans Parish prison inmates were visited by young social workers from Tulane and other local colleges. By God's will, it seemed, this was that day. As a social worker, an overweight young man with a poor complexion and wire-rimmed spectacles came in and set up a desk to interview prisoners, we decided to tell him our story in the hope that he could arrange for us to be temporarily segregated until our bond was secured. I related everything that had happened and the menace that we faced. To my dismay, when I finished my story, he quickly informed me that even though he was well aware of the horrors of the prison, there was really nothing he could do. After all, he said, most of the others are in the same boat as you. I returned to the small group of besieged white prisoners and I told Lewis and Hamilton what had happened. I had just finished when my comrades' faces froze. Towering behind me was the nameless prisoner who had confronted me 2 days before, the same recaptured murderer who was in my original holding cell. His size and reputation gave him instant command of the blacks in A1, and even smart-mouthed Derek became his quiet supplicant. With hatred again igniting his eyes, he stared in my eyes and said, "I told you I'd get you. Tonight, your ass is mine, motherfucker." At that point, we collectively decided that we had to devise a very intelligent and well-thought-out plan if we were to survive. We had no choice but to act immediately and take a big gamble. I called the lawyer whose name Jim Lindsay had given me, but unable to reach him, I left a message on his answering service. Then I went back to the social worker and told him that I informed my lawyer of the details of the situation and had given him the social worker's name. "If anything happens to us tonight," I said, "you will be the one held directly responsible." Exasperated, the social worker told me that there was no guarantee the prison administration would move us, and that by telling my story to the guards and trustees, we would put ourselves in the category of snitches, a likely death sentence if they kept us in the general population. After a quick discussion, my friends and I agreed that we had no other choice. So I went ahead and told our story to the guard who was right in front of the hostile prisoners. I demanded to see the warden. After a few minutes of arguing, the guard agreed to send me up to the administration offices. A practically senile old man came down from the warden's office to escort me up. On the elevator, I told him the circumstances of our situation. Oblivious to reality, he said we should just fight it out with them. I do not know how I found any humor left in me, but I responded. "Oh, we'd love to fight it out," I said, "the three of us against 30 vicious, hate-filled black criminals. But don't you think we'd be taking unfair advantage of them?" A smile cracked the corner of his lips, and he said, "Oh, I guess I see your point." I was able to convince the warden of our imminent peril, and he reluctantly agreed to move us, on the condition that I was certain bail would arrive the next day. He cautioned us that if we were not released, we would have to go back to A1. Uncomfortable, but safe for the moment, Hamilton, Lewis, and I stretched out on three tattered, stinking mattresses on the floor of the cell with the Black Panther drawn on the wall. Conversation eluded us, and each retreated into his own thoughts. I said some prayers and hoped that the next day would restore us all to freedom. I lay awake thinking for quite a while after Hamilton and Lewis had fallen asleep. Exhausted and anxious about the next day, I reviewed my life like a film editor reviews his footage. Things were just not working out the way I thought they would. To me, the truth had always seemed like the ultimate weapon. No matter how unpopular or reviled, it is bound to prevail. But here I was, in Parrish Prison, facing an uncertain fate, aware that the truth of our cause offered no protection and no solace. That night I matured from the fantasies of youth to the hard realities of adulthood. Right is not always vindicated by power. Sometimes truth and life itself are crushed to the earth. For truth to triumph, those who cherish it must give it more might than the lie. My thoughts turned to Chloe, and I imagined her angelically caressing my brow and visiting me with her sweet kiss. In the waning hours of the morning, sleep came to me cloaked in the ethereal visage of Chloe, who took me into her restful arms. In the morning, only a couple days before my 22nd birthday, I was out again, free to walk openly under the burning but welcome New Orleans summer sun. A black judge, Israel Augustine, had signed my recognizance bond. How ironic! With an election drawing near, no white judge would dare sign our bond for fear of being labeled a racist. Judge Augustine was obviously immune to that charge, for he was also a hero of the civil rights movement. Judge Augustine had been an ideological opponent of mine, but he earned my respect that summer day. A free man, I was able to arrange for Lewis, Hamilton, and Chloe to be released as well. That evening, Chloe and I lay in each other's arms for hours under the rumbling drone of an old air conditioner. I was thankful to be alive, thankful that Chloe was now safe beside me and that we had all come through our ordeal unharmed. Over the next few days, I re-examined my commitments. I resolved not to let the terrifying experience deter my mission. The conditions I had witnessed in jail only reinforced my views of race and the deplorable state of our civilization. Freddie O'Sullivan's corrupt and brutal attempt to suppress our movement and philosophy had left me even more convinced that my cause was right and that my enemies represented an evil force upon the world. Only an evil system would ignore the barbaric rape of thousands of men. I remember the quote that said that the best way to judge the level of civilization in a nation is by the conditions in its jails. I understood, too, that no matter how terrible the experience seemed to me at the time, it had lasted only a few days, It was insignificant compared to what many other patriots had suffered. In an historical context, many revolutionaries faced far worse incarceration, torture, and even death. No matter how difficult their imprisonment, though, most historical revolutionaries were locked up with their own comrades. In America, of the last days of the 20th century, the white dissident is likely to be locked in jails dominated by the living denizens of his worst nightmares. Over the next few days, I reread the wonderful letters written by St. Paul, some of which he had composed in the worst jails of the ancient world. My comrades and I would readily have traded the savage inmates of the modern American jail for the poor rations and lack of sanitation of those jails in Bible history. Both inside the jails and out, St. Paul kept his composure and love of the Lord and love of life. His example and inspiring words restored my strength and nourished my spirit. Now that I was out of jail, I realized that O'Sullivan and his cronies probably knew from the beginning that we would not be convicted of any crime. By terrorizing us with imprisonment, damaging us financially with legal fees, and publicly discrediting us with negative news coverage, they had accomplished their objectives. I had found out the hard way that the cause in which I invested myself was not a game. We were in a struggle of epic proportions against a vastly more organized and unscrupulous enemy. It was not enough to stand up on the street corner and tell the truth. It was about being able to defend your right to stand on that street corner. Our enemies did not want us in the game at all and were willing to go to almost any extreme to defeat us. They already tightly controlled information through the mass media. They had already put the politicians in debt to them for their favorable coverage and campaign donations. People like myself, who stepped out of the normal political boundaries, were a threat that they dealt with first by censorship and then by character assassination. Then they utilized the same apparatus every tyranny in history has used to defend its supremacy, its control of the law, and its agents. With my organization in tatters, my members and supporters intimidated, and my reputation sullied, I knew that I had to make some changes before politically organizing again. I needed credentials, otherwise I would get no respect from the press, the police, or the public. No matter how well-read I might be or how articulate, I needed a college degree, the minimum that modern society demands for credibility. I resolved to go back and finish my final year of college and to continue preparing myself for the struggle. A week later, the George Wallace campaign acknowledged quietly to the New Orleans District Attorney that I had indeed been authorized by the campaign as its representative in New Orleans. All charges against my comrades and me were dropped. We never received any financial compensation for wrongful imprisonment, of course, but I was determined as ever to find my compensation in victory over the powers that would commit such base acts. Later, perhaps as a small consolation for his campaign staff's cowardly betrayal, Governor Wallace personally appointed me to the honorary rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the Alabama State Militia. The traumatic series of events also made me fully realize the wonderful and dedicated partner I had in Chloe. And we decided to marry. The next chapter is chapter 36, The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.